Hi, it's Kristin from Salto. We are very happy to be pairing with the Co-working Assembly for this podcast episode. Salto opens the doors to thousands of co-working, co-living, and workplaces in the world. We believe community is the key, and by taking part in this podcast, you'll be able to connect more with like-minded people around the world and to help build the co-working and co-living community globally. Take a look at the link in the show notes to find out more, and we hope to meet you in person soon. Enjoy the episode.
Hey folks, welcome to this very special edition of the Co-working Values podcast. It's one we recorded specially for Global Entrepreneurship Week, where we discuss what if everyone was an entrepreneur. And that's based upon a paper by our friends at Town Square, which of the same name, which if you go to the show notes or go to their website, you can download it. And it explores how people inside and outside a company can have an attitude of Entrepreneurship Week, of starting something, of being an independent economic agent. And particularly at this moment in time, where we're all coming to terms with what COVID and coronavirus has done to the world. So we go through our own opinions. We talk about a lot about diversity and inclusion, diversity and inclusion and gender and everything affecting people beyond the economy of like how to start your own thing and what that actually means. It's a really, really good in-person chat, which we recorded here at the studio in WorkHive, which is the space I'm at in Ilford. So thanks very much to everyone for taking part. We have Kofi, Kate, and Victoria, and I'll hand them over to you now. And there's a little bit of I did this intro because there was a bit of a mess up with the beginning of the live stream, which we did. So let's go into that now.
Community is the key.
We're going to bump
across to Victoria.
Yes.
What do you know for and what would you like to be known for?
Yes, so my name's Victoria. I'm the CEO and founder of Sunmo. We are an inclusive and progressive snacking brand, and we're also moving into food technology, so we're creating this grocery delivery app that is also inclusive as well.
I'm dying to ask what an inclusive delivery app.
Yes, I will tell you all about it.
And who's this guy? What are you doing, sir?
Hi, my name's Kofi Opong. I'm the founder of a charity called Urban MBA, and we're looking at education. Is education maybe right at the moment for younger people? Has education ever been right for everybody in general? We're seeing a big divide in terms of the way people learn. So what we do is we empower young people through entrepreneurship. And give a slightly different style of learning.
Slightly different style. You're really underplaying it there, mate. So we're here today. It's Global Entrepreneurship Week. For the rest of this broadcast, that's a word I always have an issue with. So if it was called like Global Snack Week, that would be much easier.
It'd be great for her too.
I know. Maybe we should have one.
Maybe we should start one. That's another entrepreneur idea. Let's start that.
Careful with your ideas. It's all about execution, isn't it, Kofi?
100%.
Yeah. So we're going to riff with you for about 45 minutes. I'd like to be really, really organized, but most people around this table are like very creative and bouncing around. So just be prepared for that. This is based upon a paper from our friends at Town Square. I keep on looking at the TV. I'm just going to look here. This is based upon a paper with our friends at Town Square, which is What If Everyone Was an Entrepreneur? I think, as we were discussing before we came on, that's a very loaded word because most people, when they think of maybe listening at home, you'll think, I'll say entrepreneur, who pops into your head. And I'm ashamed to say that it's always Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, and even though there's millions and millions of people of other different shapes, sizes, and ethnicities have done that, that's the thing. And I was reading a book called The CEO Next Door, and they've researched like 5,000 companies, and people just think that like sort of extroverted white men run companies, and all their data shows that sort of like 6% of companies are run by those people, like Jack Welch's, and everything else is just regular human beings who live in semi-detached houses and go to play football. So it's way more
speaking for himself when he says regular. We're extraordinary.
2 point, like where the data is. So where do we kick off? Because I've got loads of notes down here. I need someone to save me. What's the first point we could go with, Kofi?
Well, I suppose we could talk about what if.
What if? Is there any technology coming that might influence what if?
There is loads of technology. Kate was going to say something.
No, go for it. No. I just wanted to say that when I think about entrepreneurs, I don't know if maybe because I am a woman, I know you can see it, but I also want to make sure everybody knows that. It's for me, actually, I don't think about those guys. One of the first one that I think is Serena Williams, always.
Yep.
And the second one is Rihanna. Mm-hmm. For me, two of the stunning entrepreneurs that have started their career in one way and then they have taken it to a whole different level and really changed the perception of everything that they do and everything. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, compliments to Jeff and Mark and everybody else. But
I agree. I don't like being contradicted on my own podcast. But, what about you, Victoria?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Because, you know, they say, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So those are our inspirations. I think growing up, I saw Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, my first entrepreneurship idol, I would say, was Lord Sugar. And it was like, okay, can I be like Lord Sugar? And there was that struggle there. But then when I see the likes of Rihanna, young girls doing it in entrepreneurship, I'm like, hey, yeah, I can do it too.
Yeah, and I think maybe when we think about that, and the traditional ones that always get pushed in your face are those three or four people, or it's you hear Google, those big companies. But the big thing to remember is that most countries, when they talk about their GDP, gross domestic product, or how the countries are run, is small and medium enterprises. So without those, countries can't actually operate properly, and there's no jobs. It isn't the Googles, the Apples and of the world that really help a country or a nation have jobs for its people to work through. It's actually the small and medium enterprises. So what we've got to remember about those is they don't get any credit, but without them, the country doesn't work. And the other thing is that small and medium enterprises are seen as 10 million in the UK. That's when you think about that. So if you're talking to somebody from a deprived and marginalized background and saying you're going to have a small and medium enterprise, but it's going to be turning over a million, minimum of 10 million to be classed as that, that's shocking for most people. But that's actually the average. So it's really important to remember that it's not those people that help a country create jobs for its people to work. It's the smaller businesses that do that.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. I think I'm so happy now that there's that awareness of small businesses aren't as small as maybe we think they are. Yeah. And also that the representation is so much broader. We live in a melting pot of cultures, and, you know, your corner shop on the road isn't often the person who is like a white male. It might be an Asian man and things like this, but they do make our economy and they do provide jobs, and they're equally as important. So, yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that.
And build a business using Apple and Google. Sorry, I couldn't help this joke.
No. But
there is a point there.
The funny thing is that we had the crash only 4 weeks ago. How many people were in trouble because their businesses had only been built on social media?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Actually, that's a valid point that you make, that actually you shouldn't be doing that, and you should have things separately away, because we see these big conglomerates as the people that we're doing things with. But most people don't understand that even if you have a business on Facebook, they technically have the rights to your business, and it's written when you sign. Mm-hmm. And many people don't know that. So actually, it's a great point that you bring up. You should be separated from them.
Yeah.
And going back to what Bernie just asked you a second ago, do you think the new coming technology that you speak about often would change this? Would be a strong element of changing this?
We have... Okay, so I want to put it this way. In 1984, Back to the Future.
Big Brother?
Back to the Future showed Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future 2, where it was a scene in it where Jaws came out through a 3D hologram and sort of tried to attack him. I don't know if anybody can even remember that far back in terms of what they used to do. That technology is now available in new 3D advertising billboards that's been trending all this year. Okay. And these 3D advertising billboards make things come out of the wall and scares people in exactly the same way as that movie showed back in 1984. Now, at that time, Michael J. Fox was supposed to be in this year period. I think it was 2026 or something, really bizarrely. And I just want to make the point that nearly every single technology that me and you may have watched, because Victoria's a bit younger, is now here. Me being the oldest, that all of these technologies have been here. And if you look at everything that is currently going on with any entrepreneur and business, it involves the internet. The shaping of these technologies in terms of the big ones, as people from deprived markets, we tend to be the end users only. So we're never at the forefront of developing that technology or being using it. So we might use it for social media, whereas Jeff Bezos had a business, recognized that the internet was coming. It then goes online and becomes Amazon. And what the problem is for me is that there's one, a lack of these new awareness of the new technologies that are going to be coming in, especially across, it just comes and bites people. And we have to be better at speaking about what these technologies are and getting people to think about it going forward in order to utilize it better for themselves. And so that is why I am always talking about that. And the next big one to your point and your question was, is 5G. Yet nobody really understands what's going on in that sector.
Yeah. I mean, I don't.
I don't. I only hang around with Kofi, so I find out what's happening in 5G.
Actually, I'm going to have to say something on you as well. Yeah. Now that there is this big thing about Facebook changing their name to Meta, etc. You were the first person I heard in my life ever, years ago, I don't know when I first met you, talking about Metaverse, and I was thinking like, what is this guy on about? And you were like, we have to prepare because this is something that will happen and it will come quicker than people think. And I was like, this guy is onto something. Like, what is he thinking? No, as in, I was like, Metaverse? What is he talking about? And it's here. It's like, it's not even starting. It's already here.
It's already here. And you made a valid point, and maybe you're going to ask me a question. But one of the things we've had with all our students on Airbnb is that they've been sending me messages, some from as far back as 2014, saying the stuff that we were talking about, it's like prophetic. How did you know all these things? It's complete rubbish. I just read things and understand that it's happening. Yeah. The problem is you have to train your mind to understand what's going on and do this. And Victoria is absolutely right. Sunmo, as a snack company, needs to become tech because that's where everything is going. And if she does not adapt her business to take into account this tech stuff, she will be left standing behind as HMV and everybody else was left standing behind when the internet came and they refused to change their model. And this is what we've got to be looking at in terms of that.
We're going to dramatically shift gears here. I'm not going to ask you a story because I'm going to put that in the show notes because that's available everywhere. You probably like can do that on autopilot. Mm-hmm. But like, what's happening for you? What I really want to ask is like, what's going on with you at number 10? I can't think of a way to get there.
But
because that small business thing, that was a huge achievement.
Yeah.
I don't like Boris very much, but that made me like wince. But the fact you got that far up the Guinness glass,
absolutely. So with 10 Downing Street, I put a tweet out when we launched into Sainsbury's, and 10 Downing Street picked it up, and they was just like, it went quite viral, and they was just like, congratulations.
Maybe a security mechanism.
We need to cap this. But I think the main thing was, it's like, and it's crazy that I'm like the youngest Black woman to launch into these stores. Probably the only one.
The first one.
And it's crazy that these organizations have been around for 50 odd years and they haven't had Black founders on their shelves just yet. So that was a big achievement that they really looked at and they said, okay, wow, we want you to come and speak to Boris Johnson. Yeah. And then, of course, I know not many people like Boris Johnson, but I think it's just representative of being able to kind of speak to the leaders of our society and ask for change. And in that conversation, I spoke about the struggles that small businesses have, you know, starting out, you don't have a huge sum of money to just throw at lawyers and accountants and production, and there needs to be that support there. So we spoke about that.
So that bit there is I always mean to come to these things with the data, but I've read tons of stuff. Is like some like 0.5% of all the investment in the UK goes to, like, one half goes to women, another half goes to people of color, and the other 99% goes to, you know, the other people. So can you say a bit about that? Is that accurate, or am I just...
Oh yeah, I mean, when I was reading some papers on VC funding, Black female founders are like disproportionately underinvested, and I mean, that's just me reading about where I'm from, but I'm sure there's so many ways that funding just isn't going to the right people. And it's not a representation. People think, okay, is it a pipeline problem? Are their businesses just not good enough? But that's not the case. A lot of founders, especially with diversity and inclusion being so key these days, when it's a woman as a founder, diversity and inclusion is the core of their business. They're going to hire from communities that are underrepresented because they represent that. And they are known to launch amazing businesses that are actually what we want, because sometimes when you're not from a certain background, you don't relate to the wants of your society. So I do think it's a horrible, horrible problem when it comes to funding to underrepresented groups.
Do you sometimes, I just imagine, did you do this on your own?
Oh, yeah, I get that all the time.
Get the package.
I get that all the time. And sometimes it's like, so I'll go to trade shows and they're like, oh, okay, so how long have you been working at Sunmo? I'm the founder of the company. And, you know, it's just, I have to kind of take it as water for ducks back now. It's like, you don't think I'm the person behind it. But I mean, when I do say, no, actually, I am the founder, or yes, I was the reason why we got Sainsbury's and these things, they're like, oh, okay, well done, like, good on you type of thing. And yeah, I don't look like a typical business person who can get their products onto these shelves.
What is it, typical?
I agree.
Yeah, I think so as well.
I agree with your question.
Like, it shouldn't be the case.
I got really scared there, you know. I'm like, just having any debate very near you.
So can I just ask you a question on that? Because it's really interesting that when we did that one in Gillette Square years ago, when you were selling, you got selling skills. And I thought that was really important, that a lot of people don't have selling skills. I gained a lot of mine from the retail business that I was in, but she was always good at selling. And that we had a very low turnout day, but her, Victoria and the one other person did really, really well.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a major thing, that if you're going to be in business, you need to know how to sell. Mm. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, that's absolutely key. And, you know, it's the, so I remember the last trade show I went to, I'm speaking to like CEO of Costa and all of these places that we would love our products to be in. And he's just like, well done. Like, that was really good. It's just making that connection and knowing that people are human. But often when I'm at these events, I think, I've wanted to be an entrepreneur since I was like 14. And I remember knocking on doors, like, usually like, do you want me to clean your garden? So I think I just picked it up from very young, that ability. But yeah, sales, I think regardless of your background, your work shows for itself. And if you can make that connection with people in sales, then that's key.
I also think that an entrepreneur approach in nowadays is less direct, but more indirect. You know, community is the key, is one of the things I like the most. But it really is like that. You know, you and I can connect in a very different way. Instead, like, at the end of the day, I am running a business. If I am the Costa CEO, for example, and I know you want to put your product in my place, but it's just the approach is very different, right? I also want to relate to you maybe in a certain way. I want to understand why do you think is the right fit and not just numbers.
Yeah.
Because my customers care about that. Their customers do care about that, about the product choice that you made. They associate that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a lot of them won't, but a lot of them will do. And I can see that in a lot of entrepreneurs that they really think that, okay, maybe the tech person's a little bit less, because it's more like a service that people use in a slightly less personal, but not even that, you know, even just, you know, the color of the application that you might use and you might put out there, or how your web page looks. Like, it's so important for everybody, and therefore it represents you and who you are. So if I am interested in buying some different type of crisps, for American friends, for a place that I run, which could be a Costa or a big supermarket or something, I also want to understand why picking yours.
Yeah.
Not just on an economical way, but like, what do they say about my brand?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would add to that. Sorry. Because there is that conversation with the buyer. What is it more than just being these crisps and the numbers that speaks to me, essentially? And then there's the upsides and downsides of that. You can speak about what you're doing and how the customers will love it, but then there's that also personal relationship. So that's what I think when it comes to speaking to buyers, that's why we need more representation, because it's like, I can probably relate to a woman more or someone from my background more, but can I relate to someone from a completely different background to me, which can be the reason why they buy from me? Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's the upsides and downsides when it comes to that as well, trying to sell to these stores.
No, it's not that I'm dying. I mean, I think the question was a bit at the beginning about funding, and we never, you know, there are some things that people can talk about in general, and there's some things you can't talk about. When it comes to funding, I'll give you an example. Being a charity, we've always struggled to get funding because, mm-hmm. as Kate was saying, we're always thinking about the future. Mm. So a great example is that everybody who's in the sector that I'm in is always about employability. But I'm aware that technology is about to change that in a big way. Totally. So we are 4, 5, maybe 6 years ahead of where most people are who are looking for funding. So when we go to look for funding and we're saying we're teaching entrepreneurship, we get turned down by 99.9% of people because they don't think it's a real world, right? So that's one thing. But I also want to point out the whole thing about what Victoria said about being a black person. I was actually with an organization that gives funding out. They'd given me my first seed funding and we were going for investment for the next level. At the same time, they were doing a report on why people from the BAME background would get the initial small grant amount. But whenever the money went over 10K, it went down to 1%. So 60, 70% of the people would apply for 5K were from BAME. Once it got to anything over 10, it was 1% only. So I'm applying for funding from them to be part of that 1%. And they then went and turned me down.
This is different from the posh 1%. This is.
Yeah, different from the first 1%. They then turned me down again. And I thought that was really, really, it was a really big letdown that you're doing a study, and they told me they're doing a study about how many black organizations get money over 10K from them. And they were doing a whole research. You know, you pay millions of pounds for that, for somebody to do research and then tell you why. When the fact is, here I am with a good, maybe, charity or whatever it is that we're doing going forward. You've already funded me once. Aren't I the person you should be taking the risk on? Because if you want to open that area up, you've got to take some risks, haven't you? And they made me go through 6 months of telling me, yes, we're going to fund you. Yes, we're going to fund you. I went into a meeting. They went, no, we're not going to fund you. Mm-hmm. And I have that organization, when I go back to them for, I very rarely go back to them for funding, because it was just like the worst thing in the world. From my perspective. And so the big thing that most people find as well from our standpoint, when you're marginalized or deprived, is that in order to get your business up and running, you need some money. And we've never been able to do that. And I'm hoping that what comes out of Black Lives Matter is that more black people get together and fund more black initiatives in order to move us forward, because that gateway is not going to change, in my opinion, from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's very important, I think, and I strongly believe in that, and we were discussing this just a few minutes before starting, to really educate the wider public into understand that entrepreneurship is not just about, you know, creating a tech product mm-hmm. that can be scalable. Yeah, I think entrepreneurship is also starting your own business with a different mentality to understand how, even in a small business, you might be able to scale in a way where you don't really have a job, because that's the difference, right? But you can actually run a business. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think there is not a lot of knowledge around that or understanding or awareness. Mm. So if you say to someone, I'm an entrepreneur, like, you know, I guess if you say to people, oh yeah, I'm an entrepreneur, they probably straight away think like, she must be doing something in tech or something, like, what do you do? Mm. You say, oh, I run this. Oh, it must be quite surprising, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I throw up on the mouth. I met very few people who said, I'm an entrepreneur, and I go, oh, so what have you done? And they said, oh, I sold my company to Kodak for 78 million. What have you done? I mean, oh, that's quite good, isn't it? And then they started lots of things. Mm. There's a load of people running around going like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. I used to sort of say as well, you know, I was trying to work out what I was about 15 years ago. And I'm an entrepreneur. So what have you done? I don't know. I copyright. So you're a freelancer. And then there's this whole thing about freelancing and entrepreneurship. Mm. And there's, and I'll, sorry. And
sure.
There's a book, called Rework by the people from Basecamp, the project software.
Oh, okay.
And they had this thing which was like, enough with the term entrepreneur, because it's very kind of like, yeah, man, I'm a... and it's almost, what do you refer to yourself as? If you say entrepreneur, that would be really awkward now, won't
I
you?
I don't mind. I never really call myself an entrepreneur. I mainly call myself, just because in terms of roles in the company, I'm more the visionary and put the plan in place and then ask, you know, impact everyone to kind of work on it, get us buys and things like that. So I call myself the CEO in that sense, and then the founder of the company. So I never really introduced myself.
So it's founder and CEO.
Yeah.
For me, yeah, and I didn't write books about it. I didn't go to Stanford University to learn about it. Yeah. For me, that's an entrepreneur. You cannot be an entrepreneur if you don't have a vision.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, back in the day, I was a hairdresser, and I didn't have the vision of an entrepreneur. I had the vision of a freelancer, of saying, okay, do you know what? I don't want to work for anyone else. I'm going to work for me. It's the same. You have a job. Like, if I would have only opened one hairdressing salon with maybe two or three people working with me, you actually work even more. While I think the entrepreneur, even in a small business, you know, when he or she starts a small business, it's the vision. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the vision, I think it's really hard to become an entrepreneur. And for me, that is the difference between a freelancer and an entrepreneur. A freelancer is someone that says, I don't want to work for anyone. I want to work for myself. I dictate my own rules, and they are happy in there. An entrepreneur is someone that has a vision and said, well, I'm starting as a freelancer, but I think I can scale this one. I can add this one. I can get more people to work with me, and we can create something bigger. So when you started, I presume you didn't start to thinking, okay, I'm going to make some crisps and then just give them to my friends around, you know, my area, and that is it.
Mm-mm.
You had the vision. Whatever then you were going to be able to achieve it or not, different matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you said, okay, I want to create this, and I want to be there. Mm-hmm. And to get there, I'm going to have to do all these steps.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because there are people that start a small business and they're happy with their own business. You know, they might have a hairdressing shop and just be happy to have a local hairdressing shop with four or five people and just live like that.
That's a very, very healthy business.
I am not saying it's not a healthy business. I'm just saying, for me, that's running a business, running a local business. And the difference with me, with entrepreneurs, is entrepreneurs have a different type of vision.
Yeah.
Like that. And to add to your point, I wrote the program for Urban MBA in 2004 while I was still working for my corporate, because already then I was like, what I'd learned, it just didn't make sense to any book that I'd read. And so in my head, I was like, somebody should have taught me this earlier. And so you then look at the problem that big and then find the solution was my course and what we were going to do going forward. But it's very interesting that you say that, because again, when I had to deal a lot with councils and with all of that, and they talk a lot about the theory of change. And as you know, nobody does anything on our courses unless you sort of understand that and have the end goal in mind and can work middle and short term backwards. Every business that's running, or big business that's running, or that gets to there, has a theory of change model, i.e. they have, to your point, the vision of where they want to go in the future. And that is what drives them. And if you don't have that, then that becomes, you're right, that becomes a problem, that your business will struggle, stop, unless somebody comes in that matches that, that can give you that next thing to go forward. So it is very important to understand what the end goal is. And what happens a lot of times is people haven't developed that mentality to think about that. And it's the thing that you need to think about first. And so in our course, we don't talk about anything to do with business until the second session. Yeah. It's all about the mindset.
The vision. I have to give props to the course. Honestly, it was so good. I remember standing there, and it was that case of, okay, I don't have any funding in this. I've got this idea. But you made us, I remember the first course was like, if money wasn't the object, what would you want to do with yourself? And then we had to write this vision board of, okay, what are we passionate about? What do we actually want to do?
Have you ever done anything like that before? Or was that like
No, I hadn't. So I had done goal setting, which was mainly, okay, I want a Lamborghini in 5 years or something. It was ridiculous.
5 years? Where's your ambition?
I know, I'm like, 5 years, girls, you've got to sell more crisps. Come on.
That's a lot of frame. And then it was, okay, so what are you actually passionate about? And then it made us think about that. And then going forward, it was, okay, this is your business idea. what are the steps to get there? And I remember doing a presentation, and Kofi would make us go up every week, like present every week. And I mean, I love presenting, yeah. So I was just like, let's do it.
I terrify people all the time with that. We've got to be careful.
But it's so good because you're held accountable. And then I remember saying in the presentation, okay, with Sunma, I want to go from Selfridges to Whole Foods Market to Sainsbury's. And there was a whole reasoning behind it, you know, so that we can maintain our price point and so that it can work effectively, cost effectively from where I am right now. Yeah. And then it's like we've written this all down, planned it out, and that's exactly the way that Sunmo went. So it was so, so beneficial.
And I think one of the duty of care in a sort of way that probably you take on, mm-hmm. and correct me if I'm wrong, because mm-hmm. obviously I don't run the courses with you, but I see when I also mentor certain people, is that there's a very subtle difference between having a vision / I dream about it, mm-hmm. and having a vision as in this is something I can achieve. Does that make sense? Okay. So you can have a vision of saying, oh, I want a Lamborghini in 5 years.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a wish and a dream. Mm-hmm. Not everybody says, okay, I want a Lamborghini in 5 years. So exactly as you said, let me work back into it. So I need to take first this step. Yeah. Maybe I need to buy, I don't know, like a Corsa for my car. My car. Go Vauxhall. Like a Corsa to begin with and get my driving license. Then I can sell some products and upgrade to, I don't know, I know the brand. And then I'll get there, right?
Yeah.
An Astra or whatever. No, but what I'm saying is that it's very different because sometimes that can actually, how do you say, turn against you, because a lot of people go like, oh, this is really hard. I'm never going to get a Lamborghini. This is not happening. And it's like, babe, it's not going to happen overnight. Yeah. For some people, it happened overnight. Maybe some singers or some, you know, people that during lockdown went crazy on TikTok, for example, and literally like within 2 months, they went from nothing to like 56 million people, right? Mm-hmm. Following them. Sometimes it happens, but it's very unrealistic. So as an entrepreneur, you know, you need to also understand, and it's very important, the difference between your dreams and what you would like your life to be and literally the vision that you need to put out to really achieve that.
A lot of that. Those steps are incredibly boring.
Very totally. Boring.
Totally.
Getting up, writing the same thing, doing the same thing. And I read years ago a lot of very, very good books. I was like, oh, yeah. And then after like 6 months, I was so deflated because I was like, God, this is fucking hard. It's very boring as well because jumping out an aeroplane with your brand tattooed to you is really exciting, but lasts for like 30 seconds. So, you know, filling in. Your expenses and property things is like sends you to sleep. Something I want to like chuck in here because I'm conscious of time. There's over there. there's two books that I've really helped. One's called Big Enough by a guy called Lee LaFever, who did all the videos that used to be like Twitter in 10 seconds and stuff like that.
Right.
And his idea is he got to a stage with him and his wife run that company, and they could have like just exploded and had a studio and made 100 explainer videos a day. And they worked out a way to make a very good living. And now he has a very nice house he's built himself on the lake and the helicopter pad probably. And he's like, this is big enough. I could have gone all the way over here. It's not, I'm not ambitious. I found a way to scale it in check. Then Paul Jarvis is like a very well-known freelancer who lives on an island in Canada and is a vegan. And his book is called Company of One. I'll put a link in the show notes, folks. And he's like, you know, people go, I'm going to be a business. So you're like, I'm going to be Bernie Mitchell, the business. It's like, and I modeled this as well, because for a long time it was like Bernie, the business of Bernie Mitchell with all these freelancers around me. So I couldn't do this. So I'd go out and get someone to do that, but I'm still like this thing. And both those men, sorry, folks, both those men, like have enough and they've scaled. So the costs are always very low, and it's just a very good business model. Mm. I think a lot of people, when I think of like everyone could, what if everyone was an entrepreneur? That's more kind of what I'm thinking of than building Ford or something like that. So comments on that, folks.
Can I start? I'm going to be brief. I think it really depends who you are and what you want to achieve. Sometimes people forget that, yes, okay, there are certain entrepreneurs, the one that you were mentioning before, that they scale to a level, and often people from outside say like, oh, they could stop earlier. Why don't they have enough? You know, like they are greedy. But sometimes it's not just for me. Sometimes it's not just a question of being greediness. And we also need to understand what they create all around them.
I agree with that.
Do you understand what I mean?
There are definitely people who are greedy, and there's people who like.
You can be greedy even without being a billionaire. You can be greedy by just having a really good, you know, job position with a good salary and still be a greedy person.
But the thing is that ever expanding. So like you make some snacks and you're in the kitchen and then you go, oh my God, I could put them in a sandwich and they could do that. And it's not like, I mean, part of us go, I'll tell that. But like most of the time is like, and then we could do that and we could do that. And then like mums could take them up there and they could be in pressurized cabins and shoot to the moon. And, and it's about.
And then it will be like you grow. The people that work with you grow with you, you open opportunities, you open doors to other things. Yeah. And then it's always easy for others to come back and say, ah, oh, but, you know, this big company doesn't treat their employees very, very nice. So, you know, Jeff is not a nice person. What does he know? He doesn't know. Like when it scales down like that, that's something that is also very important for entrepreneurs to understand. Like, you know, you either take it in this way, but you say, no, I don't want to scale. You know, I'm going to keep it in that sort of way. But if your nature is that you, you know, you want to scale, like that would be my nature. Like I love fast growth. Mm. You also need to understand that you're going to have to take people with you. And then eventually you have to learn to let go. It's true.
No, I'm laughing because we've got a big fashion brand that's come through that's taken a lot of money. Yeah. His biggest challenge right now is that.
It's to let go.
He has somebody that works. With me, who has now become part of his business. Mm-hmm. And when she's telling me some of the stuff that's going on, but before she went to work with him, the first thing that we discussed was I said, he's going to have problems with letting go. He's turning over nearly £1 million now. Operationally, he cannot do that himself, but he doesn't get that. And, you know, what's happening is he's ended up fighting with me all the time. And I keep saying to him, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. So we had a phone call about 6 weeks ago. She's like, he's a nightmare. He won't let go. Yeah. He's trying to run all the social media. He's trying to do all of this. He's trying to do all of that. He's in so much trouble. Now he's panicking and he's realized, to your point, very clearly that he cannot run it all himself.
Micromanagement is what kills the most of startups.
Yeah.
I mean, when I used to run Startup Home and being involved in a lot of accelerators, that's what I can see. You have to understand. And I'm sure you can tell us about your experience, right?
Yeah.
That if you started to cook your crisps in your home and you were packing it exactly in the same, you know, just everything was exactly as you wanted, when you are packing millions of packets, you know,
just
every month.
Sore fingers.
Absolutely.
Like you just have to also deal with the fact of saying, okay, there will be some mistakes in there somewhere. Mm. It's fine. We'll tackle them. We'll carry on and then we'll go for it.
Yeah.
That is a very subtle, I think.
We did. Oh, absolutely. So the first products that went to Selfridges were all handmade by myself, a little bit of help from my mum. But we had a commercial kitchen and I would be up to 2 a.m. just doing it all myself. And then we got a manufacturer. And like you said, there are those issues. You know, they don't take the same care that you would. They don't season it the same way that you've asked them to. And there's a lot of handholding there, but you have to come to the realization that I can't do it myself. So you have to work with outside parties and hand over things.
Like of going, yeah, my mum making the chips. Like, oh my God, there's a big factory. And look, I don't even know that guy's name and he's making my crisps. What was that bit like?
It was very much like we know it's going to look completely different. So it's not handmade anymore. So that's the plus. And then there's the aspect of they create a lot of problems. But like there's been so many issues when it comes to manufacturers. And then when I hear about other food founders, it's the same. But there's so little number of manufacturers that we can go to that sometimes our fate is in their hands. So we kind of just have to work around the errors.
So we could set up a
this is another business idea for anyone listening to food manufacturer.
Yeah. Just,
thank you.
There's a handful that everyone kind of goes to. So it's that matter of, okay, we can try and negotiate to the fact that they've made an error. Can we get the price down? Or if they're just like, no, you're not getting any money off. You just have to go with it because we don't have any other option.
Until you become big enough when they can't afford to lose you.
Yeah. But then it depends, because if you still have limited options, you still have limited options. I mean, she's big enough. What is she going to do? You should open your own food manufacturer.
This is what I was going to say, that I've seen bigger organizations do exactly that and then do that to control it themselves. And that's why I'm saying that. And if they have that fear that you have the power to do that, then they buckle under that for you. But can I just add some stats to some of the stuff that you're talking about in terms of with books. So Kate mentioned something that was very interesting, that if you don't want to scale, right? Now, the problem is, on some occasions, you have to scale because the trend in the market is changing.
Oh,
that is the big thing. So once a new technology comes in, those people that say, oh, I don't want to do all of this, you're going to be in trouble. And there's that famous story about HMV from Beechwood, that the guy who went and spoke to HMV, who was the marketer, said to them, you have two big challenges for the next 10 years. One is the internet. Two is people downloading free music on the internet. HMV threw him out because they said that this would never happen because people value paying for music and would never trash an artist. And you look at that now and you're like, what planet was that? But at that time, HMV was so big and maybe so far up their own that they wouldn't listen to anybody that was telling them. So unfortunately, sometimes with people, they don't see the trend changing and that they need to actually change to go with it, which kills their business. And then the other thing that you've just got to consider within all of that is also that all of these challenges that Victoria and everything they also had, when I've read books like Shoe Dog, the founder has always said, if I could do it all again, I would.
What's Shoe Dog?
It's got something to do with Nike, I bet. How much do you want to bet, Bernie? Yeah. How much?
Please, she's always chasing me on this one.
Nike.
I thought that was really interesting that you go through this whole bit that Victoria's talking about is actually the best part of the journey. Nobody realizes that at the time.
But yeah, they enjoy it.
The challenges that I've had with trying to get money and all that, it's now become a game.
It's interesting.
It's become a game. All right, so you don't believe in me, go away. Let's go somewhere else. It becomes, you develop that resilience if you stay in it long enough. And that's what I'm talking about, statistics, that it becomes ingrained in your nature that you don't take things so personally. You're disappointed because people don't have your vision. But then you've got to weigh up with what you want to do. And as I said, I'm an entrepreneur that's always talking about the future. What Kate said right at the beginning is very me. People always go, what's he talking about? Because it's going to happen a bit late. So sometimes I cannot relate to the funding, and people are always like, you got to play the game. So the game is, do I change my vision or sugarcoat what I want to say in order to get the money in? Or do I go with my true passion or true calling of this needs to change? And the reason it needs to change is because if it doesn't, anybody else behind me is going to face exactly
the same problem. It's true.
And that, for me, is when you're an entrepreneur with a cause and motivation, which is a bigger thing.
I think that whole thing there, sorry to be so cliched in a business chat, is when people, like Steve Jobs, like follow your passion, and then Cal Newport wrote that whole book about follow your passion versus like doing something that was like, oh, you know, if I followed my passion, it would be eating cheeseburgers. And what I'm really engaged in is like writing and creating. It's like, you know, I'm very lucky. I'm in a position now where all I have to do is like talk to people all day, and I finally admitted that I'm all right at that and connecting people. You know, I love connecting people. And that is, I wouldn't say it's my passion, but it's like the thing that I cannot not do.
I mean, to add to what both of you are saying, I think there is, when you talk about scaling your business, there are two elements. Will your business go out of business if you don't develop into technology or what have you? And then there is that purpose driven thing, you know, with Sunmo, for example. Sunmo means to bring people together with food. And I've always, even when I think about, okay, if I couldn't do this tomorrow, where you made us say, okay, if money wasn't an object, what would you want to do? It's just a thing where I want to inspire, and I see issues with the current food model. Things like the World Food Star, I don't think should exist because you don't call pasta a world food, but all of a sudden like Polish foods, Brazilian foods are packed into this aisle.
It's very interesting.
Which is...
I was having a chat about it. Sorry to interrupt.
No, okay. Very interesting.
Bearing in mind I'm sitting next to an Italian, like, so...
Coffee? You Italian?
You know, it's
really... You never told me.
Remember Rachel did her launch that time. She had some Italian friends and Rachel did pasta. They slated her. You're not Italian. You should never do pasta. That's why I
didn't.
Just
laugh. No, I way. That's terrible. I apologise to everybody. To anyone as an Italian, I apologise to anyone who's had received a certain type of comment from Italian. Our food is not the best in the world, oh, dear.
You're going to get it.
I don't care. I don't care. It's best, not.
I've had some of my best meals.
I love Italian food.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Does Italy actually make coffee? Or is it?
Well, as in, like, do they produce coffee beans?
No, they don't.
I let you Google that.
It's Africa, you know that. Yes. Ivory Coast and Ghana.
I was setting up.
Saudi Arabia as well, and South America, and there is more to come. Anyway.
You know where I'm going with that. So,
yeah.
Latin America makes coffee, Ethiopia makes coffee. Saudi
Arabia. Me neither. I found out at the Dubai Expo.
And then everyone says Italian coffee. It's like,
Yeah, and I just think it's...
Because we are the best at making a coffee. We buy the beans, but then the way we make a coffee, it's the best. What can I do?
Exactly. I mean, to that point, it's just a matter of, okay, the supermarkets don't see that as an issue, but I can't get access to some of the foods that I've grown up eating, and it's, do we lose our cultures or do we do something about it for the next generation? And I've always been passionate about the next generation and making a difference in this world. And it's like, if I go to sleep, I will get no sleep if I don't do it. So it's kind of, I know it's my purpose, so I have to do it. And then it is very scalable. So with the grocery delivery market being so huge right now, I see that's the way we can do it. Opening up supermarkets is not the model I'm looking to go down. It's more like a delivery app that is inclusive. And I want it to have this big start.
Say a bit about why it's been, because I'm dying to know.
Yeah.
I know where that energy is coming from, but what does that actually mean? And
yeah,
to people who don't know, you go like, what's that for?
Yeah. So I want to make a big statement where it's, we sell 40 ethnicities of products currently. And I'm sure there's many ethnicities that struggle with the same thing.
Yeah.
I can't get a ripe plantain at the supermarket. I have to go to a specialist food store. And I just think, whilst we're moving to a, people can get their groceries delivered to their house, you know, it's not even accessible in your local supermarket. We should also move that technology to...
Me too. I fell in love with you even a little bit more, maybe. Statement.
So, Lorena, my friends of the operation in our marriage, she's from Argentina. And nowadays, it's okay to like, when there's a drink called mate, which is that thing you see drinking. And there were two places you could buy it in Old Compton Street, and you could buy it in a specialist Latin American food shop in Richmond. And then by Seven Sisters, I think it is. Is that just down the road from you?
Yeah.
It's the Latin food market. Mm-hmm. You can't buy the Argentine one, though. You can buy the Brazilian one.
Yeah.
Also, not so much nowadays, but like 15 years ago, finding a really good Polish sausage in London was very, very hard, and I've got a lot of friends in Poland. Like, then the whole thing was like, where can you find this obscure thing? And back in my drinking career in the 90s, you'd have to go around London to find certain tequilas and rums in certain places.
Yeah.
And it was really hard. It's like, why can't you just get that stuff nowadays? Why is it so hard?
Absolutely.
And when they say that world food thing in the supermarket is almost like the shittest world food.
Yeah, it's still not inclusive. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not representative of the... Yeah, no, it's so true. And I think it even goes down to, like, the gluten-free aisle and things like that. Like, I sometimes want to have gluten-free breads. I'm not celiac or anything, but I think it should be with the other breads as well, so you can compare and contrast and what have you. So it's just that matter of, we need to be more inclusive. And with technology changing, we've got an opportunity to do that. And to have access to the foods that everyone should be able to have access to. You shouldn't have to go to a specialist Latin American place to get this drink, because we live in a culture that is multicultural.
Yep.
It's not representative of what we are in the UK and even abroad. So it's, I'm like, okay, let's actually have food that represents who we are as people.
We sleepwalk into supermarkets, we're like, oh, we'll go there. And lockdown, like in our area, loads of, there's a couple started a thing called, what's it called? Veg to Your Door. And they were a couple that like knew about the greengrocer market to begin with. And then they just, let's rent a van, get some boxes and see how this goes. And everyone went mad and they posted on the neighborhood app. And we get food from them because the food that arrives is from Leytonstone Market and it's real.
Yeah.
And our bin is so empty because there's none of that packaging and all that sort of stuff. You're going to say something there?
No, go.
Can I just add?
Love the way you are.
I think what
as opposed to me, that just intervened.
I have been talking about this. So there's a real world and then there's the world that we deal with, that we talk about, and what Victoria's talking about. So there are huge trade rules and laws at the top level that create a lot of the stuff that you were talking about. For years, Ghana, although we are the second largest cocoa producer, and one of us, we weren't allowed to make chocolate in Ghana and export or sell it abroad. There was a GA trade law that prohibited Ghana from doing that. There are these things all about at top level that stops different countries from doing different things that benefit other countries. And I think that even with what we talk about, we always talk about what the real truth of the world is and how you can go about changing these types of things. So on the face of it, at ground level, it looks like, oh, but they're just not representing Argentina. That's not the truth, really. There's other things hidden at top level that people, if you go into, it will shed more light. And I'm not going to talk.
I'm going to talk. There's a movie. It's really important. Mm-hmm. There's a movie called Black Gold, which is about how coffee.
Yeah.
Do you know the movie?
No, I haven't watched it, but
it's about how all the coffee prices and everything is set in the world.
Yeah.
When like lesser countries like Latin America and Africa, which is a continent, show up, there's like two of them, and they carry their own luggage. And when the USA or the UK or France shows up, there's like 55 of them, and they get flown in. And they, so like 27 people are able to be in every single thing where the price is set. And the other people are like, so do you want to go? I think we can only cover three today. So like they just get screwed in setting the price for everything. It's a really good movie about food.
I'm going to watch it.
I think what technology has done is managed to break down some of these rules. And let me give you an example of that, because I think it's a great point to think about that. Not all technology is bad, and sometimes it can open up situations like what we're talking about. So first and foremost, what Victoria is talking about with her grocery app is really true. If you looked at lockdown, the first lockdown, nobody knew what to do, right? It was really strange. It went on for about six months. Then we came out. Then when the lockdown happened again, how many people were ready? Everybody. They all had their stuff on apps. They were like, we've adapted straight away. The early adopter model had to be rolled out for everywhere.
Even the bagel shop up there.
Electronic payments.
In terms of that. And then let's have a look at even somewhere like the TV industry. In years gone by, if you wanted to get onto BBC and you were ethnic or one of those, you put it to the gatekeepers. And I'm not calling the BBC. And they will decide whether you go on TV or not. Okay. Then we bring in YouTube, and all of a sudden, every person is now their own content creator and producer. Now, there's a guy called Chunks. He was obviously from East Africa. He's doing really well at the moment. In days gone by, would he have ever been given the chance on the platform of normal TV to talk and do that? He would never have been given that opportunity. So what the YouTube has done, so he was invited to the World Football Charity Game. That would have never happened from an East African young black man if YouTube hadn't come along and given him that opportunity to be able to create his own content and even talk to his own people. So there are some of that some of these rules at the top level are being broken down just by technology.
But also don't forget, one thing I would like to add on that type of technology and that type of entrepreneurship that for me is extremely visionary and with purpose. Two things that for me make really an entrepreneur, you need to have purpose and have a vision, is that they straight away went global. our TV before were just local.
Oh, yeah,
so you could have as much space as you wanted on a British TV, on BBC, and unless there was something to do with something in Italy, maybe, I wouldn't ever be able to see you. And also, I wouldn't have the choice to, because the TV would decide for me. Now, what YouTube has done, and then a lot of others coming after, they first thought global, and exactly as you said, they also thought about the people. What do the people want? Which is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So you say, what are, you know, in a sort of way, the people I talk to, what do they want?
Yeah.
They want to have this sort of food delivered, but it just doesn't happen. So I'm going to solve that.
Yeah.
And the same thing was with YouTube. People were like, I want to know what's happening around the world, and I don't want to pay a subscription for, I don't know, like international TV or stuff like that.
And because of that reason, I think that it has opened up some of these opportunities where
totally.
When we're talking about you talking about the different foods in different areas, that's because sometimes it's a bit more bigger and global. And we're all working together to sort of change some of these things. And to your point, I mean, when I grew up in the 90s, every black comedy that used to come out, which was our little thing that we had, like Desmond's and stuff, would be on Channel 4, BBC Two, and it would be after 9 o'clock because you would never get prime time. Right. They put their product out at prime time when they want, right, to suit the consumers and stuff. So the gatekeepers, not only would they be there, but even when they gave you space, you would have the worst space and the worst time, to your point, and not really be talking to any. So we used to all have to huddle around that particular time to watch certain comedies and stuff like that. So I think it's important to know that, but also that there is stuff out there that is of a bigger deal that people don't realize what they're fighting against. And I suppose some of that is maybe what we face when we're trying to say we want to change the face of it. The education system is the slowest thing to change. It isn't fit for purpose. To get anything at the moment changed in that system takes a minimum of 2.5, 3 years.
I got to your point, white honourable member for East Ham. That's true, but you got annihilated in lockdown. That's one of the best things that happened in lockdown, is the education system had to like go, oh my God.
Exactly. And
we'll put a link in the show notes, folks, to Scott Galloway's book, Post Corona. And in it, he says one of the strongest brand, one of the biggest like places for brand equity in the world is places like Oxford and Harvard.
Yeah.
Because it's like zero innovation in the way things happen. Yeah. So, even us, if someone said, do you want to go to Harvard, you get a heart price, you'd probably go, oh yeah, I will. Like, even though you don't want to, you couldn't resist it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Harvard. and now people are going, so I've just done all my classes at an Ivy League university on Zoom in my bedroom, and I'm pretty much, you know, I could have just done that at the University of Essex for like a quarter of the price.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do I need this for? That's a whole new podcast, folks.
Yeah.
But this is where entrepreneurship is going back to the very topic of it. This is where entrepreneurship, I think, it's going to be even bigger. And this is why I think there's going to be more and more entrepreneurs, because people will see a lot of this. They will have a vision. They will have a purpose. And they will say, okay, no one has done it before, so I'll do it. And if I cannot work for a company that helps me doing that, or that is also fitting my purpose, then I am going to put it out there.
To bring it back, I think I would like to think, well, that's a very non-committal thing, so it's very, it's much easier for people because of the information around, for technology, to go, I'm going to start my YouTube channel, to like circumnavigate the establishment, if you like. And then also, the thing, we're going to have to say something about co-working in here, because this is a co-working podcast, but As the like in the town square thing, what if everyone could walk to work? The reason we're in this building is because I've lived in Ilford for 15 years. I've always gone into central London to go to a co-working space because that's cool. And then lockdown brought, you know, I found all in the work hive thing here. So I dropped the boy to school, walked down here, walked back. For a lot of last year, I left IG2 postcode about twice. Nobody see you actually. You know, loads of stuff happens in this building here, and I wonder what this building would be like. But it's like lots of people running, you know, ordinary businesses, but they're building businesses and they're building their local economy. And now people are not leaving their local area so much. We've spoken a lot about this. Is when people stay in the local area, they keep the money in the local area, and you had to think about they have more respect for the local area, which is even more important than money. How does that work?
Well, I think if you invest in your local area where you've come from, what tends to happen is that we need to build communities again. And communities, especially after lockdown and everything else, I think the shock to the system of people in general about what happened, nobody ever expected that type of thing. Obviously, with Corona, that we felt like we were a bit indestructible, I suppose.
Yep.
And what Corona did was make us feel like we're not indestructible. This was something that can't be seen and all the other things. I think we were going away too much anyway from communities. And we've had the whole thing where I've looked at reports from the government saying they're now going to open up youth centres again because they shut them all down and they've realised that it's become a big problem. And that's why crime in deprived areas is going up. I think co-working spaces or co-living spaces have that opportunity to help us build communities again, where lots of people are doing things, but they're working together and networking and then keeping that in the local area. And when you are in the local area, you don't want your local area to then become rubbish of where you live. You want to really contribute to it. So I think we have a double purpose with co-working spaces or co-living spaces and smart cities that are coming, is that how do we get that community element in there again? Naturally, there is no way the world can move forward unless we all work together, full stop. Yes?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Community is the key.
Oh, dear. I just saying that community is the key. Amazing.
Yeah.
I was hoping you'd say something. We've got like 5 minutes left.
Yeah. So I'm going to speak for 1 minute and then I'm going to give the rest of the time to all my fantastic co-panelists or co-guests.
I know, like, on a very, very serious note for me, I've watched you for the last 2 years speak to so many people about a community business, co-working and co-living.
Yep.
I don't know why I'm doing that with my hands, but like,
because you feel the Italian in me, right?
and like the co-living summit you did was just like thing after thing and thing about community and connection.
What is the question?
I don't know. I have this live podcast, so I'd say
okay. So no, when I was running Startup Home, and I did that for 3 years, we created a really great community. So we were based in Islington, the Highbury side, so the nice side. And we had about 100 nationalities roughly coming through in the 5 years that Startup Home was there. I ran it for 3 years. And it was really nice to see how people that come from everywhere, and some from Britain as well, so not just from abroad, found a very quick way to really link together because they have a similar purpose, where the purpose was either building a business, but also really being with people who are very similar. And exactly as you said, instead of them taking, you know, maybe transport and going somewhere else, they would be like, okay, well, we are in Islington. It was different than Ilford. Okay, fair enough. But still, if before they were saying like, okay, we're going into Central, into West End or stuff like that, often we would go out and walk. And if, as you said, you've been following me for quite a bit, you know that I am a massive fan of this concept, which is 15-minute cities that can also happen in clusters of spaces in a city. So Ilford can become a 15-minute place to live. And you were just the example. You just said it. So you walk here. You walk your kid to school. You can walk back here.
I'm really fat, and now I'm just fat.
Okay. But you can go out working. You have the restaurants. You have the working space. You have everything you need in within 15 minutes. And that takes a shift from commute to community.
Yeah, it
takes a shift from commute to community. And I think when community get together, then business thrives more.
Yeah.
And people spark more entrepreneurship because, again, you want to do it with purpose. And then together you start to have more visions.
Going back to food.
That was amazing.
So many local restaurants that we frequent now. Mm. So we ordered them online because we're like, I'm not gonna order like, you know, food from Enfield to go deliver to Ilford. Mm. And we knew them pretty well anyway, but just really, there's a coffee shop called Blend 93 up near Kent Hill Station, which is like Cheers for us now. Me and my son meet there after school. I go in there and he's like, hi, Dad, I've got a flat white while I was waiting for you. And it's this lovely, lovely sense. It's almost like Desmond, you know? it's that kind of atmosphere. Victoria, take us to the bridge.
Yeah, well, I mean, just to add to that, I guess from my experience growing up in Hackney, there was a lot of people are moving into the area because you've got close links to Liverpool Street and what have you. But I love the fact of let's build a community here, because it's like people who have grown up here, they've got somewhere where they can start their own business. They can go to a co-working space. And yeah, like with the community, a lot of people were, that was their safe space. Yes, totally. And then these co-working spaces can be the more ambitious people in the community safe space, rather than them having to be moved out because of gentrification or what have you. So I think it's an amazing way to build.
Gentrification in Slate and a podcast is a trigger word for a lot of
people. Really? but I think it's
all
a great way.
Coming in, like, making it nice.
Yeah, making it nice. But it's like there were people with great work ethic in the community currently.
I joke, but that's kind of how we met Kofi, is because there was a survey, like research done, and there's always research done, is kind of like all the people in co-working spaces in Hackney were like affluent, gentrified people. Mm-mm. And you know, my wife worked in Hackney for a long time in social services, and all the people jumping up and down on the bus stop in the riots in 2010 were like her, you know, she worked in social services, she worked with those people. Mm. And a lot of that anger there was whatever was going on, but yeah. It's also like, how come everyone's coming along taking our space, taking our home away from me, and like pricing you out?
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it again. I've started. I've opened the gentrification.
No, it's true.
And it's like there's next so podcast. Many people with amazing work ethic who have grown up here for the past 10, 15 years, and having co-working space in their area that they can utilize is so much better. So you don't have those kind of. I mean, I'm not completely opposed to gentrification. It does help communities in some ways, but it does also push people out. Yeah, it does push some people out. So it's like, rather than those really city workers coming in and having their own office space here, let's have the community have their office space here.
Because in Tower Hamlets is one of the most affluent neighbourhoods in London, and that's because over here there's like Mile End, Tower Hamlets, and that area, and over here there's Canary Wharf.
Yeah,
and it's kind of, I don't know, Canary Wharf has obviously brought a lot to that area, like the Olympics brought a lot to
Hackney. Yeah,
Hackney and the other
Stratford. Yeah, Stratford.
But there's a lot of, I don't know, rude displacement that has happened as a result of that. We have to find a way to close this up, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All these other examples coming.
End remarks from you, darling. Yes.
Well, I suppose it's Global Entrepreneur Week, so if we're going to end, maybe that's we give them about. some whole things about statistics about why you need to even do it. So I would say, for everybody out there, why do you need to consider being a freelancer, an entrepreneur, starting your own business? We have a big technological change coming. And if you're not aware, you need to be. The artificial intelligence will take a lot of the basic jobs away. So you need to have that type of thinking. And also understand that if you're going to be an entrepreneur, it is never, ever a short-term thing. Mm. And that's where I struggle with a lot of Gen Z, because they want the win-win now. Victoria, how long has your business been going for?
Oh, it's been years. And then I went to university, and then it only reached beginning of 2019, end of 2018.
Right. So what you'll find is that businesses have a 3, 5, and 7 year cycle. We've done so much research because we've been doing it for so long. Businesses have a 3, 5, and 7 year cycle. In 3 years, you'll probably need to, at the end of the 3 years, most entrepreneurs will pivot their idea because they've learned enough. 5 years is when you start breaking even. That's what always happens. And 7 years is when you generally tend to start seeing profit. So you need to know that you're in it for the long haul, because it is never going to be quick. And that is what we're having in terms of those types of things with problems. But you do need to consider this, and you also do need to consider what will happen with you in the future once these technologies start changing, and think about it in exactly the same way the internet has changed the world. Because every real major change in society, in countries, is always based on technological advances. And if you see where all the money is coming into play from the venture capitalists, it's all technology stuff, which tells you what's happening. And that's why you need to think about being an entrepreneur, and why Global Entrepreneur Week is so important.
With a vision and a purpose. Guys, don't forget that. Guys, girls, anyone, with a vision and a purpose, both. I love you, Bernie.
Really enjoyable conversation. I think it's, you know, we're talking about why should everyone be an entrepreneur, or what if everyone was an entrepreneur. But I would love to say, you know, you can work in an organization and act as an entrepreneur, you know, totally. Entrepreneurship. So it's that sense of being a self-starter, bringing things to your organization that you think need to happen in the society. You're an entrepreneur as well in that way as well. So.
That's a really important point. Like, it's not anti-jobs, it's like mindset.
And I also would like to say that if you are listening to the podcast and you think that's not me, it's fine. Not everybody has to be an entrepreneur. That's all.
That's beautiful. True. So thank you very much for your time and attention today. We're going to put links to Kate, Victoria and Kofi in the show notes. We have loads of show notes here with all the links and everything we mentioned here. If you go to the European Co-working Assembly website and hang around for 5 minutes, one of those annoying little but highly effective pop-ups will come up. You can join our email list for all the events. We run loads of projects around Europe, around rural co-working, diversity and inclusion, investment, apps and gadgets and stuff like that, and also events. One of the things coming up, if you're listening to this in January, there is the very exciting sounding Research Group for Collaborative Spaces, which is in Montpellier, which is one of the best events about workspace and stuff you can go to. It's free to attend. It's a lot of, I'm not really saying now, it's a lot of academic people that research what we've been talking about in depth, and they get together and talk about it.
Amazing.
And then we'll go out for Italian food.
Montpellier sounds a bit French to me.
It is. My Italian friend lives there with the Ducati, so that's mainly why I'm going to stay there. But thank you very much for your time and attention. This is one of the longest podcasts we ever did. I'm finding it very hard to stop because I really, really enjoyed it. So round of applause, folks.
Thank you.